Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate
Vasudevaya. So we're reading today from Canto 10, Chapter 68, Text 2, The Marriage of Sambha. Kurova kapito uchur. Kurova kupita uchur. Duvinito yam ak arbaka. Kadariti krita matnakanyam. Akama adharad balat. Kuruva kupita uchur. Duvinito yam arkabak. Kadariti kritai nakayam. Akama. Akamam adharad balat.
Kurava kupita uchu.
Kurava kupita uchu.
Duryam abakaha.
Durvitoyam abakaha.
Dharati kritina kanya.
Dharati kritina kanya. Kupita, angered. Uchu, said. Duvinita, ill-behaved. Adhyam, this. Arvaka, boy. Kadhyati kritya, insulting. Na, us. Kanyam, the maiden. Akamam, unwilling. Aharat, has taken. Balat, by force. Translation. The angry Kuru said, "This ill-behaved boy has offended us, forcibly kidnapping our unmarried daughter against her will." Translation responsibly. The angry Kuru said, "This ill-behaved boy has offended us, forcibly kidnapping our unmarried daughter against her will." So there's no purport, so we'll just read the next few shlokas. The translations are, "Arrest this ill-behaved Sambha. What will the Vrishnis do? By our grace they are ruling the land that we have granted them. If the Vrishnis come here, this is text 4, if the Vrishnis come here, when they learn that their son has been captured, we will break their pride. Thus they will become subdued, like bodily senses brought under strict control. And text 5, after saying this and having their plan sanctioned by the senior member of the Kuru dynasty, Karna, Sala, Bhrugri, Jagnaketu and Sujatana set out to attack Sambha. Purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that the elder of the Kurus mentioned here is Bhishma, who gave permission to the younger men as followed. Since this maiden has now been touched by Sambha, she cannot take any other husband. He must become her husband. Nonetheless, you should arrest him, tie him up, to make a statement about his impropriety and our own prowess, but in no case should he be killed. The Acharya also adds that Bhishma accompanied the 5 warrior members mentioned in this verse.
Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Vastaya Bhutale Srimati Hridayananda Goswami Niti Namane. Namo Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Vastaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namane. Namaste Saraswati Devam Gaudavani Pacharani Neva Sesha Srinivadi Pashachari Neshatayane.
So when you read this section, it's quite an interesting section of the Bhagavatam, the marriage of Sambha. It's pretty radical when you actually read about it. The kidnapping of this girl from the fire sacrifice, and it started me thinking on a train of thought which a lot of parents often think about, and especially in this day and age. When you're a parent, you have children, and in particular you become very protective of your children, especially your female children, and you're always worrying about, will they be protected? Will they be given shelter? Will they be okay? While they're living at home with you, parents are often really concerned, you know, all right, is everything okay? And I started to analyse this a little bit further, and because I remember, just like here we read about this kidnapping, and I remember when my parents came from Europe to migrate to Australia, from Holland. I was 6 years old and my sister was 2 years old. And the authorities on the plane made a strict point to my parents that under every circumstance you were to look after this girl, because we were travelling through some... This was 40 years ago. 45 years ago, nearly. We were travelling through some pretty rough sort of areas, and my sister was... fortunate to have really, she's a 2-year-old girl, and she had beautiful red hair, curly red hair, really beautiful coloured hair. And they said that unscrupulous people would try to kidnap her just for her hair and let her grow up in a harem in one of these Arabic sort of countries. So they said you have to pay particular care to look after your daughter, keep her under check, or otherwise she could be kidnapped. So we can see also in the papers at the moment, over the last few months, there's been this whole incident of this little child being kidnapped in Portugal. And the mother and father are frantically trying to find where this little girl is. So this is a great fear for any mother or father, any parent has this dilemma. I started to analyse a little bit further, and I started to figure out and study about the role that women played in Vedic times, and how, you know, in Krishna consciousness we say that women need to be protected. And so I analysed it a little further and started to analyse what the position was of women within the Vedic culture. And in the true Vedic culture, the women within the family were considered goddesses. They were literally considered goddesses. They were treated as such, as very prominent people, Lakshmis. And to the extent that women were worshipped, that, you know, it was very auspicious to have a girl child in your home, to have a very chaste and pure wife. It was a great boon to society. So we understand that women are a source of pleasure, both materially and spiritually. They can be materially, if your mind, if your concept is on material sense gratification, for a man, a woman is great pleasure. But on the other hand, spiritually, a woman can also be very uplifting and very stabilizing in devotional service, in a man's devotional career. So thereby, we always emphasize to young brahmacharis and young brahmacharinis to find a good life partner that one can live with to encourage each other spiritually. So Srila Prabhupada was always very, very concerned about the state of his women disciples. He was always concerned about how are the women being treated. He would ask when he would come to a temple, so are the women happy? Because he knew that if the women were happy, then the society or that particular temple would also be very prosperous and settled and peaceful. What's that old Australian saying? Happy life, happy wife. So Prabhupada was always concerned. He was the father of everyone. He was concerned that the women were always happy, happily situated. Pandit Nehru, the leader in India, once said that you can tell a nation's condition by the status of women. And this is the truth. A woman of any nation or society is actually the mirror of that civilization. So if you see that the women are very happy in their Krishna consciousness within a society, then we can understand that that society is going to grow and flourish. And I mean, you have no idea the impact. When you come into a temple like I came in this morning and there was an ecstatic kirtan, and you see the ladies dancing, chanting and dancing so nicely, and they're full of happiness with each other's association and with their god brothers, and worshipping Srila Prabhupada and worshipping the deities, that is such an indicator to say that everything is fine, everything is good. So in Vedic society, the women enjoyed a good status. And you can understand that a society is mature when women have got a good status, when a woman is completely satisfied. In the early days in Krishna consciousness, we've all read Prabhupada Lilamrita, the women shared a lot of the responsibilities within ISKCON. Every aspect of Krishna consciousness was shared, both men and women, girls and boys alike. Prabhupada was very broad in his thinking. He established the Brahmacharini Ashram. And in every way, if you read the pastimes of early Prabhupada Lila, the ladies shared in everything. As far as leading kirtan, as far as giving classes, Prabhupada nominated a few of the ladies to become GBC members, so on and so forth. There was once a complaint from a temple which was dominated by pretty severe sort of strict brahmacharis. And they said, they wrote a letter to Srila Prabhupada and said to Prabhupada, you know, Prabhupada, we love you, Prabhupada, but we think, you know how we worship the deities and greet the deities in the morning and we have this tape playing of Jamuna, and you know how Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that sound of a woman's voice agitating. We would much prefer to hear your lotus voice singing. And Prabhupada turned around to this guy and he said, I'm quite comfortable listening to this tape, because this devotee had said, you know, there's all the guitars and there's an orchestra and not very good. And Prabhupada looked at him and he said, I'm happy with it. I think it's very nice. We're doing very nicely. What's your problem? And the devotee had to eat humble pie. He said, I'm sorry, Prabhupada. It was never brought up again. But this was at one time within our society, our great society of Krishna consciousness, this was at one time the mood to suppress women's activities and roles within ISKCON. They were dark years. And fortunately enough, there were even moves afoot to actually expel women completely from ISKCON. So this is not the way that Prabhupada wanted it. Prabhupada was very much a leader in wanting women to participate in every level of Krishna consciousness. And Prabhupada also knew that if the women were happy, then the society would grow and prosper. So now we're seeing that that is coming to the fore. You know, the leaders within our movement are understanding that women are also an integral part to the development of our Krishna consciousness movement. And if we want to have any sort of real meaningful impact on today's society, the women are a very important part in reaching out and bringing new people to Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada was very open-minded. He even said that a temple presidency doesn't mean just a man ruling over a temple or directing over a temple. Prabhupada made a point that a temple presidency is a partnership with both the husband and the wife. A temple president ideally should be a married couple. And Prabhupada said the temple president then becomes the father of that community, and the temple president's wife becomes the mother of that community. And here in Melbourne, we can see how that is actually a fact. You know, that actually Aniruddha and Achintya Rupa Prabhus are really the mother and father of so many younger devotees here. And over the years, we've actually seen this develop more and more. Aniruddha was a very dear godbrother of mine, and you could see how this mood, and also Achintya Rupa Prabhu, you could see how they nurture and help in every way, shape and form. And I'm just astounded how a wonderful service they've done for this community. And so they're the mother and father of this community. I heard one devotee say the other day that they see Aniruddha as her mother, as her father. So this is so in Vedic times, the women had immense power, incredible power. We actually don't realize how powerful women were back in the Vedic time when they were treated correctly. There's one story, one legend, I don't know if you've heard this one before, in southern India. There was one king, and he accidentally killed this man. And his wife was so upset that her husband had been killed by this king that by mantra she destroyed the whole kingdom. Burnt his whole kingdom to ashes. This is how powerful the ladies were. So they were always given pride of place in any assembly. They were in any rituals. A woman had to be present. Women had to be present. If there was a fire jagya, there had to be ladies present. And ladies had to be really well adorned and honoured and so on and so forth and respected. To the extent that we read in the story of Ram, when Ram was doing the jagya, the Ashwamedha jagya, Sita couldn't partake in that jagya for some reason or other. Sita couldn't come. So Rama actually had an idol made up, a statue of Sita, a golden statue, so she was represented at the jagya. So women were so important in every aspect of life. And here we have the story of Samba. And here also the Swayamvara ceremony, the choosing of one's life partner, that's what it's all about, is mentioned here. And in other stories, you have Draupadi. Draupadi also had the Swayamvara ceremony, wanting a husband, and so it was arranged that there was the contest, which Arjuna won, shooting the arrow. Similarly, Lord Ram wanted to get the hand of Sita, and he broke Shiva's bow, and that made him qualified to marry Sita, so on and so forth. And the honour of women was incredibly important in Vedic times, to the extent that the greatest, fiercest battle that took place, the Battle of Kurukshetra, a world war, millions of people killed, came about because a lady had been dishonoured. You know, the Pandavas were not inclined to fight with the Kauravas. They weren't. They didn't want to fight anything else but fighting. They didn't want to have this bloodshed on their hands. And it was only the last straw that Draupadi was dishonoured, then Yudhisthira said, that's enough. Now we take him on. So this was an incredible thing. So You have the power of Sita. When Ravan was actually, you know, we see Ravan as this demoniac sort of monster living in Lanka, but actually he was a very learned Brahminical sort of person. He was very, very advanced. No one could defeat him. He was very, very strong, shastrically and in every way. But he had this lusty desire to actually covet Sita. And by Sita's chastity and power, he was actually overcome. He was doomed to failure, where Ram actually destroyed him. So, this happened in the Vedic times. So we can understand that over a period of time, there was a decline. It's called in India the Dark Ages of Indian culture, Vedic culture. There was the decline of women's status. And this was basically, brought about by a foreign influence. Women started to become unequal. They had a loss of freedom. They were debarred from religious practices. They lost their political clout, because women actually had a strong political clout as well. They would direct the politics of the day. They were barred from education. This was a dark age within the Vedic history, in the Indian history. And it was brought about by the foreign influence. Everybody understands how the Mughals came and invaded India. What time was that exactly? Was that the 16th century or 15th century, around about that time? Prabhu, do you know when the Mughals started to invade? The Goswamis. No, it was before that. Yeah, they'd already started to invade. So what happened was is that these invaders were barbarians, but they were barbarians. They were really unscrupulous people who, in their philosophy, in their thought, polygamy was okay. They had really no regard for women whatsoever, and so what would happen was they would invade an area and they would just capture all the women, anybody they liked, and put them in their harem. And that was it. They had no regard for women, that's it, you're in there. And so what the original Indians did, the original Vedic culture members of that society, they had to somehow or other protect women. And to protect them from these marauding barbarians, what they had to do was cover their women. Because if the women previously in the Vedic age wore beautiful saris, wore beautiful dresses, put ornaments and so on, and were just completely free to look beautiful. So what happened was, when these invaders came in, it is understood that the women started to use what's called the pura. Have you heard of that word, the pura or veil? And that's why women of this day in Vedic culture, or Vaishnava ladies, we wear saris. Ladies wear saris. But actually, Hridayananda Maharaj explains that there is no place in the Vedas where the word sari is actually mentioned, the clothing that women wear. So a sari technically has no Vedic connection. And one of the reasons why women wear a sari is because they put a cloth right over them, cover them, to protect them from these barbarian moguls who would just simply want to captivate. If they saw a beautiful woman, they said, yeah, like her, take her. So the men folk protected them. And then what happened was, slowly, slowly, the mindset of the men of that period started to change. Women were always chaste. Women were always very renounced and demure and so on and so forth. But they didn't have to hide who they were. Now, because of this marauding mob, they had to actually be given more shelter. And so things started to change. Now, if you had a girl child, it became a burden, you know. Because, God, now I have to protect this girl. Instead of being an incredibly potent asset to the society and a personality that's worshipped and honoured, and respected and understood that, oh, I have a beautiful daughter or I have a beautiful wife, she will bring prosperity and good fortune to our home. Now it was the mindset that, oh, God, I got a woman. As a child, now I have to protect her. Now I have to keep her away from these evil barbarians. So slowly, slowly, there became this burden developed in such things as, oh, well, God, you know, I don't want to look after this child for too long. I'll marry her off really quickly. So that's when child marriages started to come into the fore. And the other aspect was if a man died and the woman was still alive, a younger woman was still alive, instead of her being a burden again on her father who had just got rid of her, chuck her in the fire with the husband, and the Sati rite came into prominence. These were just the other things that were evident was restricting a person, a lady, from religious duties, and restricting a lady's educational propensity, so on and so forth. So we can understand that this is actually the progress of Kali Yuga. The progress of Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga brings about a decline in every way, shape and form. Recently I saw this, I don't know if you saw this as well, recently I saw this documentary on SBS about women in Vrindavan, the widows in Vrindavan. Absolutely astounding. Has anybody seen that documentary? You have? How modern man gets rid of their Mataji, you know, their old mother. Oh, well, we'll send her off to Vrindavan and she can just finish her life in the holy dharma. Aren't you a good son or daughter? Get rid of your mother. Now, the documentary was how they just dump hundreds of these mothers in Vrindavan. And there's one lady who actually collects all these ladies and has formed an ashram where she nurtures and looks after these ladies until they pass away. But their children have just dumped them, left them there. Much the same as what happens here in our society. And as I said once before in a class that I gave, it was one of the most predominant features of me becoming a Hare Krishna was I was working in a nursing home. And the callous attitude of people leaving their parents in a nursing home to just rot made me think, my God, there must be a broader understanding, there must be a broader family that I can link in with, that will never happen to me or my children. So we can understand that as the Kali Yuga progresses, males and females want less and less responsibilities. They want more self-gratification, more sense gratification, more selfishness is predominant within Kali Yuga. I just wanted to read one section of the Bhagavatam, of the Bhagavad Gita, where Prabhupada gives a quote from that verse of the first chapter, text 4. You know that verse, when irreligion is predominant in the family, O Krishna, the women of the family become corrupt, and from the degradation of womanhood, O descendant of Vrishni, comes unwanted progeny. In the last part of that purport, Prabhupada says, so the different family traditions of religious activity should always... So different family traditions of religious activities should always engage them. This is the ladies. And thus their charity and devotion will give birth to a good population eligible for participating in Varnashram system. So if the ladies are treated correctly, then the Varnashram system will come into play. On the failure of such Varnashram dham, naturally the women become free to act and mix with men, and thus adultery is indulged in at the risk of unwanted population. Irresponsible men also provoke adultery in society, and thus unwanted children flood the human race at the risk of war and pestilence. So there's no shortage of war and there's no shortage of pestilence in today's society. So this unprotected women, it's a very, very critical situation. Just recently... there was, you know, that there are huge wars going on in many parts of the world. One of the tactics now used in modern warfare is that when an opposing side invades the other country, like in Africa and also in Bosnia and Croatia, you've heard about these tactics. One of the tactics is the first thing that you do when you invade an area is you rape all the women in that area. So the men, the soldiers, are actually trained to rape the women. This is unheard of before, but this is actually a fact. Because what it does is it creates unwanted population. The women don't know whether they should have the baby aborted if they become pregnant or whether they should raise a child. It demoralizes any men that are left in that society because they think, God, I couldn't even protect my wife and now she's carrying this child. This is a tactic of war. This is the Kali Yuga. This is what we're fighting against. So, and if we look at society generally, in the 70s, when I first became aware of a man's position and so on and so forth, there was the women's liberation movement. A lot of you are not aware of that early days of the women later. Women would come together and they would say, we want equal rights. We want to be just as potent as men and so on and so forth. Since I remember, burn the bra. They used to have bra burning ceremonies, right? In the middle of New York City and so on and so forth, and in Melbourne also. Women would say, to hell with it, we're the same as men, and pull off their bra and chuck it in a fire. And we want the same, we want equal pay, we want equal this and that. And the men were saying, oh yes, this can be done. Yes, yes, this is very good. Because it meant that they would have less responsibilities. Yeah, we'll give you freedom. Yeah, you can. But we'll exploit you at the same token. And when the child comes, you look after it. I'm off. The man takes no responsibility. Have a look at the major crisis within today's society. Pestilence, illnesses brought about by illicit sexual behaviour. And the other thing is unwanted progeny, just as Prabhupada forecast. So many unwanted varna sankaras. And this is going on. Now, we understand that Srila Prabhupada gives us the greatest knowledge. He made no distinction between male and female, although male and female are different. He always pointed out males and females are different. But we are all spirit souls. We're all part and parcel of Krishna. We're all equally, and we all have the same equal opportunity to become Krishna conscious. So, to demoralize or to degrade or to think less of another living entity is to actually reject a part of Krishna, because that other individual is also part of Krishna. This is a fundamental point of self-realization, understanding that we are all part and parcel of Krishna, and our dealings with another individual, whether it's male or female, is that you're actually dealing directly with Krishna. So how can you possibly hate another individual or demoralize another individual? In a previous lecture I mentioned how Hridayananda Maharaj was saying, how Prabhupada often says, we should see all women as mother. Should see all women as our mother. Apart from our wife, who we see as our lover and our friend, we should see every other woman as our mother. And this whole superiority of the male ego of, I am much better. How can you possibly feel that your mother is subordinate to you? Can you feel that? Can you go up to your mum and say, I'm far more superior than you? As a male, we can't. Your mother is always, isn't it? Your mum is here. Can you feel that she's subordinate to you? You will do whatever I want. Do you feel that, Mataji? You reckon that would work? I don't think so. So we don't feel that. We don't feel that women, our mothers, are subordinate to us. Even though we may be better, like Hridayananda Maharaj said, we may be more educated, we may be far stronger, but still, our mother is not subordinate to us. We are always respectful to our mother. Prabhupada gives a clear instruction that our mother, if we see everybody as every other lady as our mother. So this is a very important point, because the mothers generate the next generation. They bring forth more sacred human beings, more living entities with that spark of Krishna. They are also the bearers of the arts. They energize, provide wealth, prosperity. But now, unfortunately, with all the new innovative power and freedom of women, they have become basically now disposable machines for our lust. You know, we praise so much the advancement of technology. But in the same token, anybody that has gone online or has got a computer and goes on the internet, you just have to open the thing up and you are bombarded by this lusty behavior, this machine of disposable lust. What in the 70s was available in the streets, this pornography has now entered into our home and you just have to click it on. So this is another area where we have to be so careful. As I was saying at the start of the lecture, for a parent, we are so concerned to look after our children. So concerned. But as the Kali Yuga progresses, we see how difficult to give protection to our children can be. It is so difficult. But we, you know, as parents, are up to the challenge to the best of our ability. So our children don't become exploited. Another huge thing at the moment in society, apart from women being exploited and being toys for men, it's children. You know, children. Pedophilia is a huge problem within society. Men are just driven nuts by lust, and so they go to the nth degree. There's the story of Ajamil. You know how Ajamil was a Brahmin in the sixth canto, and somehow or other he saw a couple making love, having sex, and he became agitated. And consequently he fell down from his Brahminical standards and so on and so forth. And what happened? He just lost the plot completely, married the prostitute and so on and so forth. Multiply that by a million times, and that's the society that we're living in at the moment. And as our kids are growing, as we're growing, we are constantly bombarded by this influence. You know? Kamaya sakaroda sharajo guna samubhava. You know? It is lust and lust only, Arjuna. This is the problem within our society. That is just, what's that actual thing? I'll just find it. Yeah, Prabhupada actually explains it. Kama sa karodasha rajoguna samubhava mahashana mahapapma vidihinami haveranam. So this mahashana, all-devouring or insatiable, mahapapma, greatly sinful or very injurious. So this lust is actually very injurious. And in the purport, Prabhupada has a real interesting thing. I'll just read this quickly. So it is lust only, Arjuna, which is born of contact with the material mode of passion, later transcend to form into wrath, which is the all-devouring sinful enemy of this world. When a living entity comes in contact with material creations, his eternal love for Krishna is transformed into lust. So it's within us. In association with the mode of passion, or in other words, the sense of love of God becomes transformed into lust, as milk in contact with sour tamarind is transformed into yogurt. Then again, when lust is unsatiated, it turns into wrath. Wrath is transformed into illusion. Illusion continues the material existence. Therefore, lust is the greatest enemy of the living entity, and it is lust only which induces the pure living entity to remain entangled in the material world. Wrath is the manifestation of the mode of ignorance. These modes exhibit themselves as wrath and other corollaries. If, therefore, the mode of passion, instead of being degraded into the mode of ignorance, are elevated to the modes of goodness by prescribed methods of living and acting, then one can be saved from the degradation of wrath by spiritual attachment. So the analysis is that this lust, which is dormant within all of us, is like a cancer. You know how cancer, actually all of us carry the propensity for cancer. So this lust is within all of us, and by certain different arrangements you can actually manifest your cancer. Or so what the trick is that somehow or other we have to keep ourselves in a state of consciousness that can protect us from ourselves, protect us from this cancer. So as a parent, it is just so hard to bring up a Krishna conscious kid. You can do the best you can. But sometimes the outside influences are so strong that no matter what you do, your child may fall prey to this lust. And what do you do? The trick is, and Prabhupada points this out, is to develop really, really strong relationships. Healthy, strong relationships. From the very start, Prabhupada says, you have to mold your children in an honest, Krishna-conscious manner. And the most important thing, it is really important to give the child Shastra. It is really important to give the child a knowledge of Krishna. It is really important to encourage a child to chant Hare Krishna. All those things are very important. But the most important thing is that they see a Krishna conscious relationship between mum and dad. That is the most important thing, because it is that will keep that child attracted to Krishna consciousness. If they see that the parents are diligently following Krishna consciousness in their sadhana, that they have a loving relationship between each other, then the child becomes satisfied and looks for that in their own life. A child models themselves after their parents. Not only their parents, but also the society and the people that they deal with. So not only if you are a good Krishna-conscious grihastha couple, are you making an effect on your children, but you are also making an effect on the community that you are living in. It is so important, because a child sees everything. A child sees everything. Don't think that a child doesn't know what's going on. At a very early age, they twig. Uh-huh. So we had the situation in this dark period of time within Krishna consciousness where the women weren't respected, where there was a degradation of womanhood in a sense, where they were being put down. Our children saw this and said, forget it. As much as the philosophy was appealing, as much as they loved Krishna, a lot of our children said, no thanks. But nowadays, because again, the women are happy, they're being looked after, strong grihastha communities are building up, just like here in Melbourne, people are becoming attracted. But whatever the case, if we diligently give a good example to our children, like I remember when Bhakti and I were raising our children, we always made a point of doing a small Bhagavatam class with our kids in the morning, letting them chant Hare Krishna, being part of our Krishna conscious development. They loved it. I would do a Bhagavatam class for them, read something out of Shastra, and I always used to read a little bit of Krishna book at the end. They loved Krishna book. And then what I had is I had a jar of lollies sitting beside me, and then we'd go over Krishna book and I'd say, okay, now guys, there's going to be prizes for anybody that remembers the things out of the Krishna book. And then I would read the story about Krishna, about the Krishna stories, and then, I'd ask questions. Okay, now Bala, what did Krishna do? Chintamani would have a hand up first. I know. Now, Bala has to answer this one. And they look forward to it. When you talk to them now, they still appreciate those pastimes that we had. So it's important that you bring Krishna consciousness, make Krishna consciousness alive in their lives. They are the future of Krishna consciousness. They are the future of this society. We have to nurture them so much so that it's so attractive for them that they'll naturally go into Krishna consciousness. Now sometimes, for whatever reason, Because of the material energy being so strong, a child may leave the devotee's association, as is the case with our kids. We did as best we could. And even in Prabhupada's children, we see that that's the case. But you never, ever reject your children, no matter what they do. There have been devotees that reject their children. Oh, you don't want to be a devotee? Get out of our house! Get out immediately! If you're not pure, get out! They lost their child. They lost their... And the child thinks, Mum and Dad don't love me. That's not where it's at. You have to continuously develop your relationship with your children. Constantly nurture them. Constantly, even if they've drifted off just a little bit. It doesn't matter. In their overall scheme, if they see, oh, Mum and Dad are still together, Mum and Dad are still Krishna conscious, Mum and Dad are still following, eventually they'll come back to Krishna consciousness. Eventually they'll come back to Krishna consciousness. It was a fascinating thing yesterday. My son came around for lunch. Now he's just sport crazy. You know, to him, life is sport. He's in the national mixed netball team. They just won the grand final. They're the Australian champion. So he came in to show the medals. And he's playing football and he's playing this and he's into music and he's into computers and he's into this and that. And Bhakti and I are thinking, oh, God. He has such potential, you know. Why don't you do it? But we never, ever push it. We know where he's at. You go for a bump. And for a half an hour I'll talk about the football, or I'll talk about his netball, or I'll talk about his latest girlfriend, or this or that. Yesterday was really interesting. His basketball coach, his netball coach, said, what does your father do? The fella goes, oh, he's Hare Krishna, he teaches meditation. Really? She said. Oh, meditation is a good thing. Did you ever learn meditation from your father? And Bala said, yeah. He said, great. You know what we're going to do? We'll get the team together and we'll have a group meditation. And Bala, you can lead the meditation. Okay. So he told me, he said, they sat them all in the corner, all cross-legged. They all had their hands like that. And they were all touching, you know, like this, the whole team. And Bala said, okay, so now you have to think of something which is really near and dear to you, which is very, very pure to you, and meditate on that and let all the other things just drift away. But you focus on that what's most dear to you in your life, which you feel is very, very important. And they all, and he said, and during the meditation, he said, you know, I opened my eyes and everybody was really blissing out. And I said, gee, that's really good, Bala. You're a bit of a chip off the old block, you know. And then Bhakti pipped up and he said, so what were you meditating on? And he said, I was meditating on the deities in Melbourne. He said, I was visualising Radha Ballabha. Well, man, I could hardly contain myself, you know. It was just like, really? You were thinking about Radha Ballabha? So this is, even though they may drift off a little bit, they will come back to Krishna consciousness. It's important that we remain stable in our relationships and always have that link with our kids. Don't mind so much that they drift. Make sure that there's good sadhana in the home. Make sure that, you know, everyone's following. Kids love heroes. Isn't it true? Kids love heroes. Who's the greatest hero within our society? Take a look at yourselves. You guys are the heroes. Devotees are the heroes. Look at our enemy. You know, you have Spider-Man or Superman and, you know, they've got their enemies, their mortal enemies. Our enemy is lust. Our enemy is desire. Our enemy, like Arjamil, it's there in front of your face. You walk out of this temple room and you'll see sexual connotations everywhere. We have to battle against that and we remain pure. We keep on developing our Krishna consciousness step by step. Similarly, in the past, we had the situation where we can't be surprised that somebody has a difficulty within their Krishna consciousness. But that's what the process of marriage is for. In the past, you know, a woman would go to the authorities, oh, my husband is so lusty, he can't get enough, and blah, 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 you know, I'm going to, and then the authority would say, how, what? he's falling down. Leave him immediately. Go away, you know. This man is a demon, you know, blah, blah. The poor guy, he's just been bombarded by material energy. He's been conditioned for so many lifetimes. And his wife is turning around and says, that's it, buddy, I'm off. So what happens then? And so many people, all of us that are a bit older in devotional service, have seen this happen. What happens? The woman is alone to raise the children. Who looks after the children? Where's the male input? Who will provide for the kids? Again, she has to go to the government, has to work somewhere to raise the children instead of a normal relationship. And then what happens? Then the lady says, oh, this is all too much, I'd like to remarry. And within hours, oh no, you can't remarry. Once the husband has left, that's it, it's over. So all these things have to be worked out. Relationships have to be worked out. Everything can be worked out. Nothing is so severe. Everything within them. And the point is that our kids are watching all this. So we have to be heroes to our kids. Our kids have to see heroes within our community. My son's hero when he was growing up was Nisringa Dave. That was his hero. He was his hero. Not Spider-Man or Superman, because Nisringa was out there doing Sankirtan. You know, he was a big, robust, Bala loved him, you know. He was his hero, shaved up and big, and he used to really fancy you too, Keshava, that he was strong. And so they look at our community, so our relationships with one another and with... A devotee should be desireless. A devotee should be caring. And a devotee should somehow or other nurture relationships. Whether it's a husband and wife, nurturing their relationship, working together, or friends, or grihastha couples, there should be a spirit of loving interrelationship. And when that happens, the women are happy. And when the women are happy, the society is happy, and we can progress. So there was one other little thing that I read, and I'll just read it out. This was from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 5th canto, where Prabhupada says, affectionate dealings with the husband are very important. So this is for ladies. It is recommended that a wife be attached and attracted to him. She must treat him with loving intimacy. It is pleasing for the husband to know his wife is devoted to him, willing to please him, and fulfill his Krishna conscious ideals. If immediate renunciation is difficult for him, this will enable a man to gradually decrease his material desire after one has been trained in householder life and his lusty desires have decreased. We can move anywhere without danger. So this Grihastha ashram is such a powerful training area. And after you get a little older, all those desires start to go down. And you start to have confidence that you can go anywhere and do anything for Prabhupada's preaching movement. And it won't sway you. So I just wanted to bring up those points that, you know, we should be really mindful of our position and our relationship with both our wife and then with our children. That this is such an important job in our Krishna consciousness to develop this. And there are just some principles that we have to play be with. That doesn't mean that we have loose relationships with members of the opposite sex. Quite the contrary. It's all friendly, but, you know, within the confines of Krishna consciousness. There's one pastime that Prabhupada had in Mayapur, which I'll finish up with, where he was in his room. I don't remember who the servant was, but he asked the servant to go and get him a dob, right? Coconut milk, a drink. And so the servant was going to hop up. And Prabhupada's sister, Pishima, as she was known to the devotees, auntie, had total freedom to come in and out of Prabhupada's room at any time. Any time. So as this devotee was just about to go out to get Prabhupada his coconut juice, Pishima walks in and sits down in front of Prabhupada. And Prabhupada straight away turns around to the servant and says, sit down! And the servant goes, huh? Okay. And he starts chanting his rounds, and Pishamas having discussion with Prabhupada and so on and so forth, and it was going on for a while, and so on and so forth. And then Pishama offered her obeisances to Prabhupada and left the room. And so then Prabhupada explained to this servant, don't ever leave me alone with a woman by myself. That's why I yelled at you. So in future, don't leave me with a woman. Now this was Prabhupada's sister. This was Srila Prabhupada. It's Prabhupada's sister. Both pure devotees. But the example is there that we have to be very mindful in our dealings with one another and very respectful and very courteous and very aware of the potency, the cancer that lies within us as lust. So any comments or questions at all that anybody may have?
Just a comment, like,
yeah, Prabhu.
As you say, that a woman, she's revered in the culture,
mm-hmm.
Historically, but it's in culture worth itself, sort of thing.
Yep.
And a woman's presence, as I think Prabhupada explained, would enhance the general good behaviour of a man.
Definitely.
And we see that in nowadays, I think the GBC is gone, they're allowing women onto the GBC body.
Yeah.
And of course, we have a general feeling within ISKCON in the last 8 years or so that things have actually a high standard of management from the top down.
Yep.
So it just made me think why Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, although it came to mind when I was thinking of the question, he was a strict brahmachari, but why it is that in the Gaudiya Math that they couldn't install more cultured women with more responsibility within his, you know, the ground roots of ISKCON, the Gaudiya Math, so that squabbling that came on after his departure wouldn't have taken place. Can you explain why that didn't occur? Because the women then would have been far more cultured than, say, Western women, not devotee women now, but Western women in general.
That's an interesting point. I think the culture within India has a lot to do with it. You know, because of what I said, the historical culture of keeping women down is really an important thing that happened at the time of Bhaktisiddhanta. I don't know whether that would have been able to have been changed during his time. Because, you know, like Prabhupada also came to the West and changed things in the West and then brought that concept back to India. And it seems like the Indians, you know, who were set in their way culturally, were more accepting of that change that Prabhupada had made when it came from the West to the East. So perhaps that had something to do with it. But you know, I really, you know, I couldn't comment on Bhaktisiddhanta, why he didn't do that. But all I know is that Prabhupada did that, and it's for the betterment.
It's a very interesting cultural aspect, isn't it? That they had to, supposedly culture that's esteemed, you know, holds women in esteem, had to see men and women come from the West in spiritual practice before they themselves would accept it.
Because as the 20th century grew on, the Indians were looking towards the West as their saving light. You know, they wanted to be so much like Western culture, you know. And then when Prabhupada changed, you know, the Western devotees, not to Indian culture, but Vedic culture, Prabhupada had not an Indian cultural attitude, he had a Vedic cultural attitude, and he brought that back to, that made the change possible, perhaps. Mm-hmm. That's the Leela, that's the way it had to go.
Saw what was possible through actually seeing it.
Yeah, good point. Thanks, brother.
I was wondering also how today, like you said, the creeping age of Kali had made earlier ISKCON sort of like the men a bit blockhead towards the women, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And as I understand, having a daughter now, we're reading a book about girls and boys, you know.
Yeah.
The women, they actually have a better communication at an earlier age amongst themselves because they're emotional, they like to share that.
Yep.
Where the men in most cultures, they don't share their emotional feelings.
No.
So I think when Prabhupada brought men and women together, in a way, what happened was why many families disintegrated, children actually saw what was going on was that the men failed to communicate well with the women.
Definitely.
And I can even say for myself today it's a very hard thing to do, because so the question could be like, how does one go about communicating on that transcendental level, supposedly, with women, or should still there be a fair distance kept and that sort of thing? And what is the ground we should be holding?
There should be incredibly good friendships and respect. That's first and foremost.
Yeah.
And then there should be a real development. Like, say, for example, from what I heard from all accounts, the retreat that Bhujan Prabhu set up, it broke a lot of bondage, a lot of barricades and you know, blockages. It's imperative, and this was something that was not present within our early days of Krishna consciousness, to share our problems with people that we trust. We have to be trusting to other people. And the biggest one, the one that's always taboo, is sexual problems. Within our society, if a man or a lady had a sexual problem, you would not tell anyone. And you would stew, and you would keep it to yourself, and you would keep it to yourself, and like a cancer, it festered and festered and festered and festered, and then all of a sudden, it pops out. And all of a sudden, we find out, oh, the temple president was a pedophile. He's having sex with his own children. That's how, to the extent that it came, at some stages, within the history of ISKCON. Because this person had no one to go to and say, hey, listen, friend, I'm actually really, really troubled by sex. What do I do? How do I cope with it? And seek help. But instead, the false ego, pride, I'll be right, I can push through with this, and then pop out somewhere else. Sannyasis, who were powerful preachers, were running down to St. Kilda to have sex with prostitutes. They kept it all to themselves, and then all of a sudden it came out. Oh! Prabhupada wasn't dismissive of them. Prabhupada didn't say, oh, you rascal, get out of my society. No, we can make this better. We can work on this. It's the Kali Yuga. You're influenced in so many ways. The most important thing is that a man has the guts to go up to somebody that he trusts, not necessarily a guru. You don't have to burden your guru with it. That a man or a lady, you know, because as it said in Bhagavad Gita, this is the all-devouring sinful thing. This is it. You know, if we can conquer this, to mitigate this desire. And it will slow down in due course of time, but in this, you know, we have to be able to confide with other people and say, hey, listen, I've got this problem. What do I do about it? You know, seek counsel. And we didn't do that in the early. And that is the whole thing of building relationships, building trust with somebody that you can reveal everything. And forget your pride. You know? So often we think, oh, I'm the only one that's afflicted with this thing. Oh, mea culpa, you know, whacking yourself. Oh, how can I?
Was it,
mate, it's every one of us is afflicted with this disease.
Bhakti Prabhu, was it that strong, you know, that nobody in the 80s could discuss problems with anybody?
Talk to any of the older devotees, right. They'll tell you. Nobody talked about it.
So it sounds like there wasn't much common sense going on.
Exactly. And now, luckily, common sense is starting to come into it. And just be honest about it. We're fallen conditioned souls. You're not going to be a pure devotee in the next, you know, flash. But we all thought, you know, now we're in Krishna consciousness, it's only a matter of a couple of years and then I'll be fully realised and I'll give the persona that I'm really, really fixed up. And in your dark little corner, you've got material desires. And you think, my God, I'm the only one. And then all of a sudden, when you talk to your mate about it, it's like, actually, you know, I've got this problem. Oh, really? Yeah, so have I. And then you find out, hey, actually, we're all struggling. And you reckon Krishna is so... I have had people, I have counseled people, young brahmacharis, who have problems sexually, have killed themselves over this. You reckon Krishna is really that concerned about some sexual deviation that a person has? He wants your love for eternity. This is just a flash in the pan. It's nothing to him. Brush yourself off. Keep going. Be heroic. You know, okay, you've fallen down this time. Okay, see how long you can go. A month, 2 months, 3 months, a year. Yay! Another badge. Make yourself proud. That's how you conquer it. And with the help of your friends, with your relatives, with your relations, because these people are your family. These people have your well-wishing sentiments. Yes, Melody?
I don't agree that in the 80s it was like that.
Yeah.
We had choices.
True.
Everyone had the choice.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone was so looking after their reputation.
Bingo.
That they could not speak. But we always had a choice.
Yes, of course you did.
We always had a choice. It's a volunteer situation.
Yeah, I take your point.
It's not a matter of, or you have to go out on Santa time and do all this. If you wanted a big reputation, surely you had to do that. And you had to give up, you know, whatever else.
Yeah.
But not everyone was like that. And had a lot of good,
very
close relationships were formed in those days.
Yeah, it's true.
As well, it wasn't only the 80s. And let us see what is to come in the 2000s.
There were, history does prove though, you know, that there were some major mistakes made. There's no two ways about it.
The sannyasis that were running down to King's Cross?
Not King's Cross, St. Kilda.
St. Kilda.
You figure it out.
No, I don't want to figure it out.
No, but it's a fact.
My life.
Yeah.
So, it's interesting that you're saying that Maharaji being a Maharaji.